from PRI, Public Radio International.
Restrictions on admission were difficult to enforce tactfully. A visiting Methodist bishop, two Taiwanese economists, an entire girls' softball team from Darien, an eminent Canadian poet, the archery champion of Hartford, the six members of a black rock group called the Good Intentions, an ex-mistress of Ali Khan, the lavender-haired mother-in-law of a Nixon advisor not quite of cabinet rank, an infant of 6 weeks, a man who was killed the next day on the Merritt Parkway, a Filipino who could stay on the pool bottom for 80 seconds, two Texans who kept cigars in their mouths and hats on their heads, three telephone linemen, four expatriate Czechs, a student Maoist from Wesleyan, and the postman, all swam as guests.
That was Campbell Scott reading John Updike's story, The Orphaned Swimming Pool, which will be featured later in this second of two radio programs devoted to a celebration of the Ray Award for the short story. This is Selected Shorts, a celebration of the short story, a series that originates in live performance on stage at Symphony Space in New York City. I'm Isaiah Sheffer. The Distinguished Ray Award is given annually to a living American or Canadian writer whose published work has made a significant contribution to the short story as an art form. The award is made for originality and influence on the genre, and we celebrated its 20th anniversary in a special program at Symphony Space. Let's go now to the stage of Symphony Space, where I introduced award winner John Edgar Wideman and other past Ray Award winners.
Stories of our next reader have brought in from radio listeners all around the country the most stirring mail, and I'm happy to bring to the stage John Edgar Wideman.
Good evening. I have 37 stories. Lots of time. Obviously, lots of friends. The story I'm going to read is called Cuckoo. I'm learning their lingo. The birds I hear first thing mornings, last thing at night. 10:30, 11, my dinner about over. Light, dying late, dinner late, as is the custom this far north in Brittany. Birds whose distinctive pigeony cuckooing frames my days, you could say. A presence I can count on afternoons as well. When I sit and read in my garden, they coo loud and often, especially these mid-July days, which I guess might be their mating season because of fierce, invisible rackets exploding deep in thick foliage, and the birds' goofy arrogance on the roads, strutting or puttering along, tiny heads bobbing with a ghetto bebop nonchalance, till the very last instant before dodging a car's tires, pale breasts teased inches above an onrushing windshield until they lift finally, fast and furiously, miles overhead, their far away cries shattering rural calm. Mourning doves might be their name in English, but if I'm correct or not, matters less than the fact I'm teaching myself to translate their language into English. Not phrases or sentences yet, a single word at a time. I hear loneliness at dawn and loneliness again at dusk, though in between there's only frantic beating of wings, endless chasing, one cuckooing at another, whether another listens or not, each one speaking alone, always, the solitary cries a sounding of this world's silence, resonating in another world's silence, every cry different, but also an eloquent, careful repetition and mocking echo of itself, a language of mirrors. I'm learning cuckoo, cuckoo, cuckoo.
The list of wonderful writers keeps going on, and here's another one, Joy Williams.
I'm going to read the very beginning of a story called Escapes. When I was very small, my father said, "Lizzie, I want to tell you something about your grandfather. Just before he died, he was alive, 15 minutes before. I had never known my grandfather. This was the most extraordinary thing I had ever heard about him. Still, I said, no. No, my father said. What do you mean, no? He laughed. I shook my head. All right, my father said. It was 1 minute before. I thought you were too little to know such things, but I see you're not. It was even less than a minute. It was 1 moment before. Oh, stop teasing her, my mother said to my father. He's just teasing you, Lizzie, my mother said. In warm weather once, we drove up into the mountains, my mother, my father, and I, and stayed for several days at a resort lodge on a lake. In the afternoons, horse races took place in the lodge. The horses were blocks of wood with numbers painted on them, moved from one end of the room to the other by ladies in ball gowns. There was a long pier that led out into the lake, and at the end of the pier was a nightclub that had a 20-foot-tall champagne glass on the roof. At night, someone would pull a switch, and neon bubbles would spring out from the lit glass into the black air. I very much wanted such a glass on the roof of our own house, and I wanted to be the one who every night would turn on the switch. My mother always said about this, "We'll see." I saw an odd thing once there in the mountains. I saw my father pretending to be lame. This was in the midst of strangers in the gift shop of the lodge. The shop sold hand-carved canes, among many other things. And when I came in to buy bubble gum in the shape of cigarettes, to which I was devoted, I saw my father hobbling painfully down the aisle, leaning heavily on a dully gleaming yellow cane. His shoulders hunched, one leg turned out at a curious angle. My handsome, healthy father, his face drawn in dreams. He looked at me, and then he looked away as though he did not know me. My mother was a drinker. Because my father left us, I assumed he was not a drinker, but this may not have been the case. My mother loved me and was always kind to me. We spent a great deal of time together, my mother and I. This was before I knew how to read. I suspected there was a trick to reading, but I did not know the trick. Written words were something between me and a place I could not go. My mother went back and forth to that place all the time, but couldn't explain to me exactly what it was like there. I imagined it to be a different place. As a very young child, my mother had seen the magician Houdini. Houdini had made an elephant disappear. He had also made an orange tree grow from a seed right on the stage. Bright oranges hung from the tree, and he had picked them and thrown them out into the audience. People could eat the oranges or take them home, whatever they wanted. How did he make the elephant disappear? I asked. He disappeared in a puff of smoke, my mother said. Houdini said that even the elephant didn't know how it was done. Was it a baby elephant? I asked. My mother sipped her drink. She said that Houdini was more than a magician. He was an escape artist. She said that he could escape from handcuffs and chains and ropes. They put him in straitjackets and locked him in trunks and threw him in swimming pools and rivers and oceans, and he escaped, my mother said. He escaped from water-filled vaults. He escaped from coffins. I said that I wanted to see Houdini. "Oh, Houdini's dead, Lizzie," my mother said. "He died a long time ago. A man punched him in the stomach 3 times and he died." "Dead," I asked, if he couldn't get out of being dead. "He met his match there," my mother said. Thank you.
Please welcome Tobias Wolff.
I was asked to jury this award a couple of times, in addition to having the great honor of receiving it and having several parties in honor of it. And one of the benefits of this was getting to know Elizabeth and Michael. And I miss Michael not being here tonight. He was a man with tremendous passion and joie de vivre, a great sense of humor, fun to go out with. And I remember talking to him one night about Maupassant, whose stories he loved. And we started talking about this great Maupassant story, Ball of Fat. And he recounted reading that story as a young Marine serving in China after World War II. And then he started talking about his life as a young Marine over there in garrison, the long, boring hours when things weren't too exciting, and how he had contracted this great love of short stories as a way of connecting with some larger world than the one he was in, these stories that were such essential expressions of our nature and our condition became so valuable to him. And as he spoke about this, I could feel his gratitude. And it is his gratitude that really has brought us all here tonight, that governed so much of his life. And I can think of nothing better than gratitude as a foundation for a life. I'm going to read a very short story tonight. It's called That Room. The summer after my first year of high school, I got a case of independence and started hitchhiking to farms up and down the valley for day work, picking berries and mucking out stables. Then I found a place where the farmer paid me 10 cents an hour over minimum wage, and his plump, childless wife fed me lunch and fussed over me while I ate, and I stayed on there until school started. While I shoveled or hacked weeds out of a drainage ditch, I'd sometimes stop to gaze out toward the far fields where the hands, as the farmer called them, were bucking bales of hay into a wagon, stacking them to teetering heights. Now and then, a bark of laughter reached me, a tag end of conversation. The farmer hadn't let me work in the hay because I was too small, but I beefed up over the winter, and the following summer, he let me join the crew. So I was a hand, a hand. I went a little crazy with that word, with the pleasure of applying it to myself. Having a job like this changed everything. It delivered you from the reach of your parents, from the caustic scrutiny of your friends. It set you free among strangers in the eventful world, where you could practice being someone else until you were someone else. It put money in your pocket and allowed you to believe that your other life, your inessential, parenthetical life at home and school, was just a sop to those deluded enough to imagine you still needed them. There were 3 others working the fields with me: the farmer's shy, muscle-bound nephew, Clemson, to whom I condescended because he was only an inexperienced boy, and 2 Mexican brothers, Miguel and Eduardo. Miguel, short and stolid and solitary, spoke very little English, and rakish Eduardo did the talking for both of them, and then some. While the rest of us did the heavy work, Eduardo gave us advice about girls and told stories in which he featured as a trickster and deft, indefatigable swordsman. He played it for laughs, but in the very materials of his storytelling, the dance halls and bars, the bumbling border guards, the clod-brained farmers and their insatiable wives, the larcenous cops, the whores who loved him. I felt the actuality of a life I knew nothing about, but somehow contrived to want for myself, a real life in a real world. While Eduardo talked, Miguel labored silently beside us, now and then grunting with the weight of a bale, his acne-scarred face flushed with heat, narrow eyes narrowed even tighter against the sun. The farmer had a big spread with a lot of hay to bring in, and he should have hired more hands. He had only the four of us, and there was always the danger of rain. He was a relaxed, amiable man, but as the season wore on, he grew anxious and began to push us hard and keep us longer. During the last week or so, I spent the nights with Clemson's family, just down the road, so I could get to the farm with the others at sunup and work until dusk. The bales were heavy with dew when we started bringing them in. The air in the loft turned steamy from fermentation, and Eduardo warned the farmer that the hay might combust, but he held us to his schedule. I was limping, sunburned, covered with scratches. I could hardly get out of bed in the morning, but although I griped with Clemson and Eduardo, I was secretly glad to take my place beside them, to work as if I had no choice. Eduardo's car broke down toward the end of the week, and Clemson started driving him and Miguel to and from the decrepit motel where they lived with other field workers. Sometimes, pulling up to their door, we'd all just sit there, saying nothing. We were that tired. Then one night, Eduardo asked us in for a drink. Clemson was a good boy and tried to beg off, but I wouldn't let him. I got out with Miguel and Eduardo, knowing he wouldn't leave me. "Come on, Clem," I said. "Don't be a homo." He looked at me, then turned the engine off. That room, Jesus. The brothers had done their best, making their beds, keeping their clothes neatly folded in open suitcases, but you got swamped by the smell of mildew the moment you stepped inside. The floor was mushy underfoot and shedding squares of drab linoleum, the ceiling bowed and stained. There was another unsettling smell behind the mildew. Clemson was a fastidious boy, and as he writhed in distress, I made a show of being right at home. We poured rye whiskey into our empty stomachs and listened to Eduardo, and before long, we were all drunk. Then someone came to the door and said something in Spanish, and Eduardo went outside and didn't come back. Miguel and I kept drinking. Clemson was half asleep, his chin declining slowly toward his chest and snapping up again. Then Miguel looked at me. He slitted his eyes and looked at me hard without blinking and began to protest an injustice done him by our boss, or maybe another boss. I could barely understand his English, and he kept breaking into Spanish, which I didn't understand at all. But he was angry. I understood that. Then at some point, he went across the room and came back and put a pistol on the table. The pistol was right in front of him. A revolver, long barrel, most of the bluing worn off. Miguel looked at me over the pistol and resumed his complaint, entirely in Spanish. He was looking at me, but I knew that he was seeing someone else. I had rarely heard him speak before. Now the words poured out in an aggrieved sing-song, and I saw that his own voice was lashing him on somehow, the very sound of his indignation proving that he had been wronged, feeding his rage, making him hate whoever he thought I was. I was too afraid to speak. All I could do was smile. That room. Once you enter it, you never really leave. You can forget you're there. You can go on as if you hold the reins, that the course of your life, yea, even its length, will reflect the force of your character and the wisdom of your judgments. And then you hit an icy patch on a turn one sunny March day, and the wheel in your hands becomes a joke and you no more than a spectator to your own dreamy slide toward the verge, and then you remember where you are. Or you board a bus with 30 other young men. It's early, just before dawn. The buses always leave then, their lights dimmed, to avoid the attention of the Quakers outside the gate. But it doesn't work. They're waiting, silently holding up their signs, looking at you not with reproach, but with sadness and sympathy, as the bus drives past them and on toward the airport and the plane that will take you where you would not go. And at this moment, you know exactly what your desires count for, and your plans, and all your strength of body and will. Then you know where you are, as you will know where you are when those you love die before their time, the time you had planned for them, for yourself with them, when your daily allowance of words and dreams is withheld from you, when your daughter drives the car head on into a tree. And if she walks away without a scratch, you still feel that dark ceiling close overhead and know where you are. And what can you do but what you did back then in this awful room, with Miguel hating you for nothing and a pistol ready to hand? Smile and hope for a change of subject. It came this time. Clemson bolted up from his chair, bent forward, and puked all over the table. Miguel stopped talking. He stared at Clemson as if he'd never seen him before, and when Clemson began retching again, Miguel jumped up and grabbed him by the shirt and pushed him toward the door. I took over and helped Clemson outside while Miguel looked on, shrieking his disgust. Disgust! Now he was the fastidious one. Revulsion had trumped rage, had trumped even hatred. Oh, how sweetly I tended Clemson that night. The farmer's barn burned to the ground that winter. When I heard about it, I said, "Didn't I tell him? I told him I did. I told the stupid not to put up wet hay." Thank you.
That was the Ray Award winner Tobias Wolff reading his story, That Room. After our break, we'll be back with a story by John Updike and some thoughts from Mr. Updike himself. You are listening to Selected Shorts, recorded live in performance at Symphony Space in New York City and at other venues nationwide from PRI, Public Radio International. Welcome back to Selected Shorts, recorded live at Symphony Space in New York City. Symphony Space's season is sponsored by Zabar's, offering the nation a taste of New York. Coffee, gourmet foods, and gift baskets available online at zabars.com. John Updike was the 2006 winner of the Ray Award for the short story, and here is Campbell Scott to read Updike's The Orphaned Swimming Pool.
The Orphaned Swimming Pool. Marriages, like chemical unions, release upon dissolution packets of the energy locked up in their bonding. There is the piano no one wants, the cocker spaniel no one can take care of. Shelves of books suddenly stand revealed as burdensomely dated and unlikely to be reread. Indeed, it is difficult to remember who read them in the first place. And what of the old skis in the attic, or the dollhouse waiting to be repaired in the basement? The piano goes out of tune. The dog goes mad. The summer that the Turners got their divorce, their swimming pool had neither a master nor a mistress, though the sun beat down day after day and a state of drought was declared in Connecticut. It was a young pool, only 2 years old, of the fragile type fashioned by laying a plastic liner within a carefully carved hole in the ground. The Turner's side yard looked infernal while it was being done. One bulldozer sank into the mud and had to be pulled free by another. But by midsummer, the new grass was sprouting, the encircling flagstones were in place, the blue plastic tinted the water a heavenly blue, and it had to be admitted that the Turners had scored again. They were always a little in advance of their friends. He was a tall, hairy-backed man with long arms and a nose flattened by football and a sullen look of too much blood. She was a fine-boned blonde with dry blue eyes and lips usually held parted and crinkled as if about to ask a worrisome or whimsical question. They never seemed happier nor their marriage healthier than those 2 summers. They grew brown and supple and smooth with swimming. Brad would begin his day with a swim before dressing to catch the train, and Linda would hold court all day amid crowds of wet matrons and children, and Brad would return from work to find a poolside cocktail party in progress, and the couple would end their day at 11 when their friends had finally left by swimming nude before bed. What ecstasy! In darkness, the water felt mild as milk and buoyant as helium, and the swimmers became giants, gliding from side to side in a single languorous stroke. In May of the 3rd summer, the pool was filled as usual, and the usual after-school gangs of mothers and children gathered, but Linda, unlike her, stayed indoors. She could be heard within the house moving from room to room, but she no longer emerged, as in other years, with a cheerful tray of ice and a brace of bottles and Triscuits and lemonade for the children. Their friends felt less comfortable about appearing, towels in hand, at the Turners on weekends. Though Linda had lost some weight and looked elegant, and Brad was cumbersomely jovial, they gave off the faint, sleepless, awkward-making aroma of a couple in trouble. Then, the day after school was out, Linda fled with the children to her parents in Ohio. Brad stayed nights in the city, and the pool was deserted. Though the pump that ran the water through the filter continued to mutter in the lilacs, the cerulean pool grew cloudy. The bodies of dead horseflies and wasps dotted the still surface. A speckled plastic ball drifted into a corner beside the diving board and stayed there. The grass between the flagstones grew lank. On the glass-topped poolside table, a spray can of Off had lost its pressure, and a gin and tonic glass held a sear mint leaf. The pool looked desolate and haunted. Like a stagnant jungle spring, it looked poisonous and ashamed. The postman, stuffing overdue notices and unanswered solicitations into the mailbox, averted his eyes from the side yard politely. Some June weekends, Brad sneaked out from the city. Families driving to church glimpsed him dolefully sprinkling chemical substances into the pool. He looked pale and thin. He instructed Roscoe Chase, his neighbor on the left, how to switch on the pump and change the filter and how much chlorine and algitrol should be added weekly. He explained he would not be able to make it out every weekend, as if the distance that for years he had traveled twice each day, gliding in and out of New York, had become an impossibly steep climb back into the past. Linda, he confided vaguely, had left her parents in Akron and was visiting her sister in Minneapolis. As the shock of the Turners' joint disappearance wore off, their pool seemed less haunted and forbidding. The Murtaugh children, the Murtaughs, a rowdy, numerous family, were the Turners' right-hand neighbors, began to use it without supervision. So Linda's old friends, with their children, began to show up to keep the Murtaughs from drowning each other. For if anything were to happen to a Murtaugh, the poor Turners, the adjective had become automatic, would be sued for everything right when they could least afford it. It became then a kind of duty, a test of loyalty, to use the pool. July was the hottest in 27 years. People brought their own lawn furniture over in station wagons and set it up. Teenage offspring and Swiss au pair girls were established as lifeguards. A nylon rope with flotation corks meant to divide the wading end from the diving end of the pool was found coiled in the garage and reinstalled. Agnes Cleefield contributed an old refrigerator, which was plugged into an outlet beside the garage door and used to store ice, quinine water, and soft drinks. An honor system shoebox containing change appeared upon it. A little lost and found, an array of forgotten sunglasses, flippers, towels, lotions, paperbacks, shirts, even underwear, materialized on the Turner's side steps. When people that July said, "Meet you at the pool," they did not mean the public pool past the shopping center or the country club pool near the first tee. They meant the Turners. Restrictions on admission were difficult to enforce tactfully. A visiting Methodist bishop, two Taiwanese economists, an entire girls' softball team from Darien, an eminent Canadian poet, the archery champion of Hartford, the six members of a black rock group called the Good Intentions, an ex-mistress of Ali Khan, the lavender-haired mother-in-law of a Nixon advisor not quite of cabinet rank, an infant of 6 weeks, a man who was killed the next day on the Merritt Parkway, a Filipino who could stay on the pool bottom for 80 seconds, two Texans who kept cigars in their mouths and hats on their heads, three telephone linemen, four expatriate Czechs, a student Maoist from Wesleyan, and the postman, all swam as guests in the Turner's pool, though not all at once. After the daytime crowd ebbed and the shoebox was put back in the refrigerator and the last au pair girl took the last goose-fleshed, wrinkled child shivering home to supper, there was a tide of evening activity. Trysts, Mrs. Cleefield and the Nicholson boy most notoriously, and what some called overdramatically, orgies. True, late splashes and excited guffaws did often keep Mrs. Chase awake, and the Murtaugh children spent hours at their attic window with binoculars. And there was the evidence of the lost underwear. One Saturday, early in August, the morning arrivals found an unknown car with New York plates parked in the driveway. But cars of all sorts were so common, the parking tangle frequently extended into the road, that nothing much was thought of it, even when someone noticed that the bedroom windows upstairs were open. And nothing came of it, except that around supper time, in the lull before the evening crowd began to arrive in force, Brad and an unknown woman, of the same physical type as Linda but brunette, swiftly exited from the kitchen door, got into her car, and drove back to New York. The few lingering babysitters and beaus thus unwittingly glimpsed the root of the divorce. The two lovers had been trapped inside the house all day. Brad was fearful of the legal consequences of their being seen by anyone who might write and tell Linda. The settlement was at a ticklish stage. Nothing less than terror of Linda's lawyers would have led Brad to suppress his indignation at seeing from behind the window screen his private pool turned public carnival. For long thereafter, though in the end he did not marry the woman, he remembered that day when they lived together like fugitives in a cave, feeding on love and ice water, tiptoeing barefoot to the depleted cupboards, which they, arriving late last night, had hoped to stock in the morning, not foreseeing the onslaught of interlopers that would pin them in. Her hair, he remembered, had tickled his shoulders as she crouched behind him at the window, and through the angry pounding of his own blood, he had felt her slim body breathless with the attempt not to giggle. August drew in with cloudy days. Children grew bored with swimming. Roscoe Chase went on vacation to Italy. The pump broke down, and no one repaired it. Dead dragonflies accumulated on the surface of the pool. Small, diluted toads hopped in and swam around and around, hopelessly. Linda at last returned. From Minneapolis, she had gone on to Idaho for 6 weeks to be divorced. She and the children had tan faces from riding and hiking. Her lips looked drier and more quizzical than ever, still seeking to frame that troubling question. She stood at the window, in the house that already seemed to lack its furniture, at the same side window where the lovers had crouched, and gazed at the deserted pool. The grass around it was green from splashing, save where a long, lying towel had smothered a rectangle and left it brown. Aluminum furniture she didn't recognize lay strewn and broken. She counted a dozen bottles beneath the glass-topped table. The nylon divider had parted, and its two halves floated independently. The blue plastic beneath the colorless water tried to make a cheerful, otherworldly statement, but Linda saw that the pool, in truth, had no bottom. It held bottomless loss. It was one huge blue tear. Thank God no one had drowned in it, except her. She saw that she could never live here again. In September, the place was sold to a family with toddling infants who, for safety's sake, have not only drained the pool, but sealed it over with iron pipes and a heavy mesh and put warning signs around, as around a chained dog.
The Orphaned Swimming Pool by John Updike, read for us by Campbell Scott. It was a great pleasure to have John Updike with us that night, and here he is, speaking from the stage at Symphony Space.
Thank you. Thank you for that fascinating, to me at least, reading. I suppose that's the most Cheever-esque of my stories. Cheever and I, although we were 20 years apart, and some inches different in height, we're often confused for a period. Both having the name John, we both appeared in the New Yorker, we both appeared to write about, we both did in fact write about suburban discontent and sorrow. So he would get congratulated on his lovely story, A&P, and I would be thanked for The Swimmer. Might even have been the swimmer in my mind that I wanted to write that story. I never have owned a swimming pool, but I'm grateful for this honor and award because my short stories have, do I dare say this, have meant a lot to me. Between 1957, when I impulsively decided to leave a paying job in New York and move up to New England and try to support myself and my growing family as a freelance writer. Between 57 and 68, when a novel called Couples came out and made some money, I depended upon short stories to provide me not only with aesthetic pleasure and the benefits of confession, but they supported me. Most of them, I should really say the New Yorker supported me, but they supported me through the short stories. And it is with some sadness that I reflect that I don't see how any young writer now could do that. Fewer magazines print fiction. Those that do print less of it. Somehow the 50s and 60s dollar, when you received the thousand or more for a short story, stretched quite far. And in that small town where I made at least as much as my neighbors. And if I met the quota of six short stories a year, I had made a living wage. So when young writers ask me how to do it without this magazine market, I don't know what to tell them. I think it's short story has always been somewhat between a longer fiction, a novel, and a poem. And it, as we've heard also tonight, and it has that delicacy which a poem can have of not a word being out of place, you feel. A novel is always some words out of place. Mass increases by the square of linear dimension so that a mosquito can't be enlarged into an elephant. A novel has to have those heavy elephant legs somehow to carry you through the 300 pages, whereas a short story can just flit into your consciousness and be gone. And I made those stories in those years out of my life, not exactly duplicating my life, but I was taking out of an ordinary New England bourgeois existence, taking enough stories to live. And I thank the Rays, Michael and Elizabeth, for founding this lovely prize for a form that isn't given prizes very often, although it continues to live and attract attention and praise. But it's a genre that could use a generous prize such as this. And I'm grateful to the judges who decided my time had come. And I'm grateful to my colleagues for providing me, and I hope all of you, with really a wonderful evening of short story magic. Thank you. Thank you.
The master storyteller John Updike, celebrating the 20th anniversary of the Ray Award for the short story at Symphony Space. To round out this celebratory program, here's a story by the 2007 winner of the award, Stuart Dybeck. Philip Kasnoff reads Killing Time.
Between job interviews, I'd wander around the Art Institute, killing time. The Art Institute was on the park side of Michigan Avenue, across the street from the towering office buildings in which the employment agencies were situated. It felt soothing to drift among the paintings. Several had begun to feel like old friends. Visiting them beat sitting over a lukewarm coffee in some greasy spoon, spending another afternoon studying not only the want ads, but the faces of the others at the counter who sat nursing their coffees as they grimly studied the want ads, too. By now, I spotted their faces everywhere. I'd become aware of an invisible army armed with want ads, pounding the pavements, knocking on doors, hoping opportunity would answer. It was an army without the consolation of camaraderie. I'd learned to recognize its unconscious salutes, its uniforms and ranks and outposts, personnel offices, coffee shops, and stands of public phones from which its lonely campaigns were launched. I'd been looking for a job for over a month and was beginning to feel desperate. The Art Institute was my base of operations. Its public phones were usually empty. Its restroom was modern and clean, with a full-length mirror, perfect for last-minute inspections before heading out on an interview. My first couple of weeks of job hunting, I'd hung out at the public library. Unlike the Art Institute, admission to the library was free. But the longer I'd gone without work, the more an old dread crept back into me, a feeling from high school, a memory of dreary Saturdays when, loaded with note cards for research papers that I was hopelessly behind on, I'd enter the public library only to end up wandering around lost, wasting the day. I remembered how the summer before I'd started high school, my father had insisted that I spend a week at the library researching professions and the biographies of successful tycoons so that I'd have some sense of direction during my high school years and not live up to his nickname for me, the dreamer. And I recalled how, rather than doing what he'd asked, I'd only pretended to go to the library, and instead had spent the money he'd given me at movies and record shops. Now his dire predictions seemed to be coming true. My money was running out. I couldn't find a job. After a week of hanging around the library, I began to recognize the same set of regulars. People who carried their possessions in bags or wore them all at once, who seemed to be living in the library stacks. Soon I expected them to begin winking at me, giving me secret greetings I didn't want to recognize. The public phones in the public library were always busy. In the old restrooms, fluids pooled on the cracked terrazzo, and the homeless hung around inside, smoking, sometimes washing out their clothes in the plugged sinks. Even on the brightest days, I began to notice the gray, gloomy cast of the marble corridors and flights of stairs. The reading rooms, dominated by the glow of green-shaded desk lamps, seemed worn as old railroad stations. There was a smell of musty pulp, of thumbed covers, of too much print. At the long reading tables, I could spot the displaced and dispossessed, drowsing over enormous tomes, or reading aloud to themselves as if engaged in debates with the complete works of Marx and Engels, Spengler, Tolstoy, Schopenhauer. While outside, the windows, cooing pigeons, paced back and forth along the crusted slate ledges. The Art Institute, by contrast, seemed flooded with light. Not merely the light streaming from skylights or the track lights focused on paintings. The paintings themselves appeared to throw an internal light the way that oaks and maples seem aflame in the fall, from the inside out. My favorite painters were the Impressionists. On days when it seemed as if I would never find a job, when I was feeling desperate, I'd stand before their paintings and stare at them until it seemed I could almost step into their world. That if I closed my eyes and then opened them, I'd find myself waking under the red coverlet in Van Gogh's bedroom at Arles. I would open my eyes in a room of pastel light to find that one of Degas' dancers, who had been sleeping beside me, had discarded her chemise and was stepping into her morning bath. Or I would awaken, already strolling without a care, in and out of patches of precise shade, one of the Sunday crowd along the river on the island of La Grande Jatte. I wanted to be somewhere else, to be a dark blur, waiting to board the Normandy train in the smoke-smudged Saint-Lazare station. I wanted a ticket out of my life, to be riding a train whose windows slid past with a landscape of haystacks and winter fields. Might be taking me to the beach of Saint-Adresse, where the fishing boats have been drawn up onto the sand, and a man with a telescope and his daughter by his side looks out to sea. Or to Pourville, where the wind gusts along the cliff walk and a woman opens an orange parasol while white sails, hardly taller than the white-capped waves, pitch on the blue-green sea. Yet I would always end my walk through the paintings, standing before the diner in Edward Hopper's Nighthawks. Perhaps I needed its darkness to balance the radiance of the other paintings. It was night in Hopper's painting. The diner illuminated the dark city corner with a stark light it didn't seem capable of throwing on its own. Three customers sat at the counter as if waiting, not for something to begin, but rather to end. And I knew how effortless it would be to open my eyes and find myself waiting there too.
That was Philip Kasnoff's reading of Killing Time by Stuart Dybeck. Our radio producer, Sarah Montague, talked with the 2007 Ray Award for the Short Story honoree.
Stuart, thank you so much for speaking with us, and congratulations on being the 2007 Ray Award for the Short Story winner. I was talking to Elizabeth Ray a little while ago, and she had talked about the history of the award and some of its rituals, and she particularly made the point that they are so excited when they get a chance to phone the winner. Can you describe that experience for me?
Well, I think they were at a restaurant, which is where I was. I was having breakfast at a Greasy Spoon, and my cell phone rang. And Elizabeth identified herself and then didn't have anything to say. I think what happened was she suddenly had an emotional lump in her throat. And the reason was that many years ago, when Michael Ray, who founded the award, was still alive, I had been one of three judges who was on a panel that selected Grace Paley as the winner. And Grace had just passed away. I think that just all came back to her as a kind of a circle now that I was getting the award. And it turned it into a kind of an emotional moment for both of us. Although I could hear her panel of judges chuckling at her inability to tell me exactly why she had called me. Finally, she managed to blurt it out. So it didn't have any of that kind of canned formality that things can have when nobody knows each other. In fact, it was a very friendly, warm, lovely moment.
Well, she said that that's very much what they wanted, that they feel that the award is a community of writers and a piece of good news that comes from friends to friends.
Well, that's what makes it so special, is that it is an award by one's peers, people who care deeply about the art of the short story. And so the entire award is graced by that.
Well, not to be indelicate, but this is an award that comes with a fairly substantial cash contribution. And John Updike, the 2006 winner, in his remarks from the stage of Symphony Space, mentioned that when he was a young man and decided, somewhat recklessly, to make his living out of short stories, this was really possible, that he could actually make a living that way. And he said regretfully that he thought that it was unlikely that young writers today could take that risk.
I think that he's exactly right. He was the last transitional figure. One looks back to stories about Scott Fitzgerald living the high life in days when the short story form was the engine for a lot of magazines like Collier's and Argosy and mainstay in magazines like The New Yorker. But today there's just so few magazines. Nonfiction really has pretty much taken over.
You teach creative writing, of course. Do you wind up warning your students that they're about to start hoeing a very stony row if they go into this field?
The arts in general are so dicey. It isn't something that's just particular to people who are working in that genre.
Do you feel it's partly that in this country the arts tend to have to prove themselves as commodities before they're valued?
I think that's a large part of it. You know, much of what goes on has to do with advertising and investments. So things like symphonies and operas and ballet and all the great cultural institutions are really competing against top 40s and so on and so forth.
I suppose in some ways the Ray Award is like the top 40 for short stories.
Well, it's wonderful that there is an award that singles out the short story, because the story itself pretty much lives now in literary magazines, which do not have a huge readership.
Stuart, if you could just talk a little bit about the story Killing Time, which we are featuring on this program, which feels to me like a little bit like a memoir.
A lot of what I write, like the work of any number of other writers, has a strong autobiographical feel to it. And that story is actually could have easily been a section in a memoir, because it represents very strongly something that happened to me.
You've done a number of stories that are grounded in painting, and I'm wondering if you could talk a little bit about that, because, of course, Killing Time ends with that lovely, dreamlike moment where the narrator is essentially trying to enter the painting in some way.
Well, that relationship between one art form and another has always fascinated me, and that Hopper painting has always haunted me.
Finally, Stuart, if this isn't too shy-making, The Ray Award is given for not a specific story, of course, but for what they describe as contributions to the form. If you had to stand outside yourself, what would you say was, in fact, your contribution to the form?
I guess if I could answer the question by just qualifying it, what I'd like to think my contribution to the form of the short story would be a kind of homegrown combination between creating an imaginary world that melds with a real world so that the urban aspect of my work is frequently rooted in the fantastic, but the work is very specific about real places and real times. So that kind of hybridization, I'd like to think, led to a voice that was pretty immediately recognizable.
Thank you, Stuart. Stuart Dybeck, speaking with us from his office at Northwestern University.
You've been listening to Selected Shorts, a celebration of the short story. I'm Isaiah Sheffer. Thanks for listening. If you enjoyed this program, you may be interested in a special commemorative CD of the Celebration of the Ray Award for the Short Story. Go to our website, selectedshorts.org. Selected Shorts is produced by Catherine Minton and directed by Isaiah Sheffer. The executive director of Symphony Space is Cynthia Elliott. Our radio producer is Sarah Montague. The readings are recorded by Miles B. Smith, and our mix engineer is Stu Kennedy. Major support for Selected Shorts is provided by Houghton Mifflin, publishers of The Best American Short Stories, edited in 2007 by Stephen King, and by Barnes & Noble, booksellers since 1873, and on the web at bn.com. Additional support is given by the Dungannon Foundation, sponsor of the Ray Award for the Short Story, the Lila Acheson Wallace Theater Fund in the New York Community Trust, the Henry Nias Foundation, the Axe Houghton Foundation, the Arthur Foundation, and members of the Symphony Space Literature Producers Circle. Public funds come from the National Endowment for the Arts, which believes a great nation deserves great art, and the New York State Council on the Arts, a state agency. Selected Shorts is a co-production of Symphony Space and WNYC Radio in New York and is distributed nationwide by PRI, Public Radio International.
Support for this program comes from this station and Public Radio International stations nationwide and is made possible in part by the PRI Program Fund, whose contributors include the Ford Foundation and the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation.
PRI, Public Radio International.